and surpassed penetrating and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. I want to talk this morning about a fortune cookie. That may seem like an odd topic of a Dharma talk. However, about 8 or 9 years ago, I'm not sure when it was, I was probably with Reverend Master Phoebe, my colleague who lives with me at Pine Mountain Temple. We were probably eating in a Chinese restaurant somewhere, and I got the, you know, requisite fortune cookie at the end of the thing, and, you know, you break the thing open, and you get your little piece of paper, and one side has a little saying, and on the other side there's numbers, you know, like you're supposed to, you know, use these numbers in the lottery or something. I don't know what it is, but the piece of teaching on this piece of paper was the following: be willing to accept joy in the face of adversity. Now, I was floored because this is a Buddhist teaching of the first order. And this happens to me a lot. I will receive Buddhist teaching not from reading a scripture, a sutra, hearing a Dharma talk or whatever. I will get it from the most unlikely of things, like a fortune cookie. And this happens to me repeatedly. I don't know why, but the universe, you know, works in such a way that, okay, for you, Seikai, there's all sorts of different ways in which Kanzayan can manifest, okay, one of which, in this case, with a fortune cookie. I took the thing and pinned it up on my bulletin board in my room, and it remains there to this day, because it's such a useful piece of teaching and one that I strive not to lose sight of. Now, just in this one sentence, there are a number of very important words. Willingness is one. We, of course, talk often about willingness. Be willing to accept. Accept, of course, is yet another very important part of our practice. Reverend Master Jiyu herself would say that all acceptance is the key to the gateless gate. Anyone here remember that from years ago? In fact, I think somewhere or another, maybe the Berkeley Priory, there was this, wasn't there a placard that said that right above the meditation hall, the entrance to the meditation hall? Another one of those very short, pithy little aphorisms: all acceptance is the key to the gateless gate. Be willing to accept joy. Now, joy is an interesting word. We don't talk all that much about joy in Buddhism, but I think we should, which is one reason I'm doing so today. Be willing to accept joy, and I'd like to talk a little bit about what that is. In the face of adversity, now, I'm going to change the word face here to heart. And because face, well, it's a common turn of phrase, you know, you learn something in the face of adversity, etc. But I would like to change it to heart, because I think for Buddhists who practice meditation and take the teaching very deeply into ourselves, we need to learn what is meant by the heart of adversity. What is meant by the heart of suffering. Like, I would say that a pretty good synonym for adversity might be suffering. Great Master Bodhidharma has his teachings on the four practices of the Zen tradition. We start with acceptance of suffering, acceptance of adversity. We may not know where our adversity originates or our suffering, where that comes from. He said, quite frankly and in a very straightforward manner, that we have inherited karma from previous existences. The Buddha said this very same thing. So no matter what you might think or not think about the existence of past lives or the inheritance of karma from previous lives, I think we're all here, at least in part, because on some deep intuitive level we recognize that we all suffer and we would like to do something about that suffering. And we, on some level or another, however deeply intuitive, we realize that it originates with the lives of previous beings. And all we've done as human beings is, as Reverend Master Jiva used to say, we've inherited a critical mass of karma from previous existences, okay? And taken on ourselves the unenviable work of converting it. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do, I realize that. But nevertheless, here we are. Bodhidharma's four practices include the acceptance of suffering, which is to stop stop grumbling about it, stop being sorry for poor little me with my big load of suffering, and learn to accept it. Acceptance of suffering. My former roommate here in the monastery, who many of you can remember as Reverend Kinsey, wrote a delightful hymn on Bodhidharma's teaching, which is the first verse of which is, "You came from the west, from India's shore. You taught us the truth of practices four: acceptance of suffering, sitting unmoved, the seeking of nothing, enlightenment proved." I love that little verse. It's easy to remember. It's one of those little bits of Dharma that boils down a huge amount of teaching into one easily remembered verse. And I recite it to myself regularly because of how valuable it is. Sitting unmoved. What is sitting unmoved? Sitting unmoved is deep acceptance, as Reverend Master Ji said, all acceptance of whatever comes to the surface, whatever we experience as human beings. Sitting unmoved, the seeking of nothing. Now we're getting into fairly deep water, because the seeking of nothing, of course, is almost an abstract, because as human beings, we seem to be wired for seeking something. We're always at least trying to feel halfway good. We're at least trying to accomplish something during the course of the day. We're trying to gain some understanding of ourselves as a result of our Buddhist practice. So seeking, trying to accomplish things, these are very much hardwired into us as human beings. So how can we seek nothing? Well, I'll try to expand on that a little bit. And in doing so, I would like to make reference to Reverend Echo, the former abbot here, who everyone, of course, loved very much and respected very much, and that includes me. However, he made various mistakes in his training, and go back in time, probably 17 or 18 years, something like that, to the early 90s. I can remember sitting with Reverend Master Jiu in her sort of lounge area, and she turns to me and says, "You know, Sekai, the thing that worries me about Reverend Echo, although I love the man dearly and he's an excellent monk, is his idealism." Now, at the time, I said to her, "Well, he's not the only one who suffers from that particular problem." Because I have my own very healthy swatch of idealism, which I've endeavored to convert over time. Nevertheless, if I had to do it over again, I realized that she was probably trying to engage me in conversation about this, and I failed to take the ball. The ball was in my court, and I just didn't do anything with it, to my regret, but, you know, that was then. This is now. I think idealism is something that we need to ponder in the wake of Reverend Echo's departure here as abbot. And recall to mind one of the opening lines of, I believe it's the Sandokai. Here born we clutch at things, and then compound illusion later on by following ideals. What is an ideal? Isn't Buddhism idealistic? Doesn't Buddhism set up for us various standards and ideals by which we can guide ourselves, learn to train ourselves? For instance, the precepts. We endeavor to keep the Buddhist precepts. Well, my understanding of this is that we need ideals to the extent that we give ourselves, we point ourselves in the right direction. This is how I'm going to endeavor to live my life. I'm going to endeavor to live by the precepts. In Mahayana Buddhism, we have 16 precepts, as you all know, and most of you have taken those precepts formally at a Jukai or some other lay ordination ceremony. Now, it's my belief, and I think the belief of the rest of the monks of my order, that those 16 precepts are completely adequate for training. And as you all know, Reverend Echo was quite enamored with the Vinaya, which is the monastic code of conduct for monks. And if one does undertake ordination in the Theravada tradition or various other traditions, one, as a male, takes 230-odd Vinaya precepts, and as a female, over 300. I won't get into that. There are so many extra precepts for women. It was, of course, at the time considered to be for their benefit. And that, of course, is, you know, for that particular path of training. But I would like to emphasize here that in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, of which we are a part, the 16 precepts represent the very essence, the boiled down, the distilled essence of the Vinaya. And further, Reverend Master Jiyu, in her teaching here, and in her establishing of this monastery and the order of Buddhist contemplatives, took quite considerable care to review the Vinaya and set up rules for the monastery and for the order which kept to the spirit of the Vinaya. And so, in a sense, what we have is a distilled and focused form of monastic rules for training and just general precepts to live by, the 16 precepts. So the 16 precepts are adequate. Okay? We have to embrace this, that they are adequate. They go very, very deep. They are kaleidoscopic, as Reverend Master Jiyu used to say. They don't address, you know, how many sticks you can use to clean your teeth during the course of a week, you know, and that kind of thing. They don't describe the minutiae of life, which many of the Vinaya rules do. But they give us the spirit of it. And within that, there is a certain amount of flexibility to take them deeper and deeper. So having an ideal of perfection, if we hold on to it, if we idealize it, and I think it's probably good to look at the word idealism and realize that actually the first four letters are idea, okay? It's an idea that you have, that this is better in some way than what we already have. Okay? So if you do that, if you set up an ideal of something, that is better than what you already have, then you have a duality which creates on the one hand a kind of perfection or ideal, and on the other hand an imperfection and an inadequacy. Okay? So I would like to look a little bit this morning at this koan, which we all have, every one of us here, because we're Western people, we're steeped in a duality of adequacy and inadequacy. And believe me, all of us, we have this koan, we suffer from it. I suffer from it. The suffering that I have today is minuscule compared to what it was when I entered monastic life over 30 years ago, believe me. So it's not an evil thing, okay? It's not a big obstruction unless we allow it to be by clinging to one side or the other. And you can cling to the ideal of perfection or adequacy, which is a mistake made by the former abbot here. You can cling to it. That does not mean to say that you shouldn't have an ideal. Okay? We have ideals. We just shouldn't cling to them. The scripture says, here born we clutch at things and compound delusion later on by following. We follow and cling to ideals. Okay? Equally, and this is the more common pitfall that we all make, is that we cling to the idea of an inadequate self. Okay? Probably many of you were here at one or the other of River Master Khotan's retreats that he held on the Buddha Mothers, the mandala of the Buddha Mothers. And one of the main bits of teaching from that retreat was on this very thing, the delusion or the suffering of clinging to an inadequate self. Okay? Having a self is one thing. We all have a self. And again, that is not per se, that is not the problem here. The problem is that we define it, we cling to it, we convince ourselves that we're either adequate or inadequate, that we're perfect or imperfect, or any one of a million variations in between, and we create this self-identity that we then cling to and believe. Okay? Now, what Buddhism is teaching us, what our practice, what the precepts ultimately are teaching us, is to learn to let go of that. Okay? Why do I need a perfectly well-defined idea of an inadequate self or an adequate or perfect self? Okay? Why do we insist on getting stuck with such definitions? Why can't we simply learn to be fluid in these things? Okay, now the fluidity comes, as Bodhidharma says, from sitting still and accepting things as they are. Acceptance of suffering, sitting still with things the way they are, which most of what we sit still with is me, for any one of us. You sit and look at a wall, you sit and look at a meditation screen or what have you, and you listen to your own mind. You listen to the you know, machinations, the workings, the judging, the commentary, you know, the I'm not good enough stuff, the I'm, you know, I've got this licked kind of thing. Why did I do what I did yesterday, and what am I going to do tomorrow kind of things. All these little storylines. Okay, that's just the workings of a brain. That's just the workings of having a human mind and having a self. As long as we're able to reflect upon it, serene reflection meditation, we reflect upon it, we see that it exists and we allow it to flow past, we learn to refrain from grabbing on. We learn to refrain from following these ideas of who we are, who we would like to be. Okay? If you create an idea of a perfect me, a perfect self, and then strive to become that, you will create unhappiness for yourself, inevitably. Believe me, because I've tried it. Many people have tried it. It's a favorite thing to do in monastic life, is to try to be perfect, try to live up to some ideal. The universe has other ideas, unfortunately, for those who try, or for better or for worse. The universe has other ideas, because the universe, the Buddha mind, the Buddha nature, knows us inside and out. In fact, we aren't separate from it. We are like fish swimming in the ocean of Buddha nature. It's one of my favorite metaphors. We may not know that we're swimming in water because we've never experienced anything else. We don't know what it's like to be in any other medium, so to speak, than a fish who is swimming in water. So we lose sight of the fact that we're actually swimming in the ocean of the Buddha nature. Okay. We've all, shouldn't use the pronoun we, you, all of you who are either members of this community as monks or closely associated with it as lay trainees have over the past 3 months experienced considerable adversity. Your beloved, excuse me, I'm going to drink some water. The abbot, Reverend Echo, felt like it was appropriate for him to disrobe and leave behind his work as abbot here and go back to lay life. This, of course, was very, very difficult to bear. Very difficult to accept and find meaning in. Very difficult to accept and find the teaching in it. But believe me, there will, over time, be considerable teaching that will come forth from it. I'm certain of that. And in my brief time here, which is only 5 days, I've been witness to many people giving expression to the teaching of what we can learn from the disrobing of a monk who had been a monk 38 or 39 years. Anyway, there is adversity. And in the heart of that adversity, there is joy. Okay? And joy, as I said before, is not a term we use a lot in Buddhism, but I think it's one that we should become familiar with. Unlike a more worldly definition of joy, which might refer to some kind of happiness, you have a new granddaughter, there's a new baby, everyone's all happy about that. They're full of joy. There's 100 or 1,000 or more things in life that can bring us temporary joy, temporary happiness. But as I said before, I'd like to look at the heart of adversity and find joy there. Okay? Another of Reverend Master Jiyu's teachings was that we all inherit karma. We all have a karmic inheritance, legacy, whatever, however you want to look at that. We have suffering. And the purpose of practice is not so much to work on that suffering and get rid of it. Okay? You can try that, and it might work to some extent. I did. I speak from experience. You might get a certain distance doing that, but ultimately you will run up against a sort of immovable obstruction, which is that there is a desire to remove suffering altogether, and that desire is an idea. It's an ideal. That's another one. Darn. Ran into another ideal. How am I going to get around this thing? The desire to remove suffering. Well, what Reverend Master Jiyu taught was that we have suffering. The ideal, the point of it is not to attempt to get rid of it, but to convert it. Okay? So here's deeper spirituality. Here's where deeper spirituality begins. This is the essence of it, is to embrace adversity, to learn to embrace suffering. And the difficulty is that, as always, we can err very easily on one side or the other, as I was talking about before, with an ideal or how we view ourselves. We can easily err with an idea of a perfect me or a better me. We can err on the side of wallowing in the idea of an inadequate self. Similarly with embracing adversity, embracing suffering, you yourself as an individual cannot really make it go away. Unfortunately, we're just not wired and equipped for that. But what we can do is what Reverend Master Ajio described as being like a small piece of pipe, which is part of the waterworks of the cosmic Buddha or the universe or however you want to look at it. And allow suffering, allow adversity to flow through your little piece of pipe and to offer it up to that which is greater than yourself. Now, doing that, what you're doing is stepping out of the way of the inherent difficulty or pain of the suffering and offering it and letting go of it. Letting go is a term that gets used a lot, rightfully. Letting go is what we need to learn to do. We do it via learning to embrace that which is difficult. We learn to accept and embrace our adversity. And if we do this long enough, that very suffering, the very thing that we thought was separating us from the longing of our heart, which we thought was separating us from knowing the Buddha nature or knowing the unborn, it becomes converted into a joy that we already do know. We already are within the deep, deep peace and contentment of the Buddha nature. So that's Bodhidharma's, the third of his four practices, seeking nothing. We're not seeking to get anything in the sense of I want to become a perfect monk or I want to have a perfect monastery. Rather, we accept what is. You train with what is. You learn to just face and accept your adversity, your suffering. Offer it up to something greater than yourself. Allow it to flow and rest contented in the non-seeking of doing so. Non-seeking is fathomless. We can't really describe it. It's limitless. It is an aspect of the Buddha nature. It's unborn, unchanging, undying. And it is joyful. We can find joy any time we wish just by going to that place in the center of our being. We all have this. We all partake of and are part of the Buddha nature. If we just can learn to sit still in the center of our own being, not attempt to make things perfect, but nevertheless still make effort. We make effort to look at and free ourselves from suffering. We're not just sitting there and saying, well, this is me, I'm a mess, I have all these doubts, you know, I'm unhappy, it's been this way for 20 years, meh. You know, you can do that. I think we've probably all done that to some degree or another. That's the delusion of buying in to the idea of an inadequate self. Okay? You can buy into that. You can buy into the idea of I'm going to become a perfect person somehow. Perfectly enlightened, perfectly something or other, X, Y, Z. Fill in the blank for yourself. But what we're really doing is following the middle path. The third position, as my master described it, between these opposites, holding on to nothing whatsoever. That is to seek nothing and to prove enlightenment. It's interesting. The way the hymn that I referred to earlier was written, it doesn't say that you become an enlightened person. Okay? Like you're forever shrouded in, you know, some kind of gold thing and, you know, that's it. You've made it for the rest of your life. You're enlightened. Rather, you've entered into, very deeply, into a process of proving enlightenment true for yourself, which is quite a different thing. And it's beautiful in that there's nothing static in it. It's endless, and there's always movement within it. An ideal might be helpful in that it, like if you're navigating a boat, you can refer to the North Star, you can refer to the sun at noon, which is always going to be directly in the south. At night, you can look at the constellations. It's good to have a point of reference or an ideal, okay? But don't hold on to it beyond its usefulness. Learn to just flow with the reality of things as they are. Okay, so be willing to accept joy in the heart of adversity. This is something that we can all do. We can all choose to be joyful. We can choose to rest contentedly in the depths of our own being, in the center of our being. Hence, my preference for the use of the word heart, the heart of adversity. That's what I have to say this morning. I hope that it was helpful to all of you. Do you normally have question and answer time? You don't. Okay.